Pod Save the World is brought to you by ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol. Let me tell you, if there's a surefire way to wake up feeling fresh after drinks with friends, it's pre-alcohol. ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. It was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's a buildup of this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for rough days after drinking. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. Just remember to make pre-alcohol your first drink of the night. Drink responsibly and you'll feel your best tomorrow. Listen, I will not have a drink without a ZBiotics beforehand. I don't understand why anyone would even consider doing otherwise. It is works miracles for me. It's a great thing to have just kind of sitting in your house if you have a work dinner or something, or if you decide to meet some friends on a Tuesday when you normally wouldn't have a drink. Just give it one shot. Get one pack, try it one time. I promise you, you'll not regret it. From the start of baseball season to music festival circuits, April is a sprint of outdoor celebrations. Don't let a rough next day keep you from the sidelines. Drink pre-alcohol to stay ahead of the game and make the most of every sunny Saturday. Go to zbiotics.com/PSTW to learn more and get 15% off your first order when you use PSTW at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee, so if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember, head to zbiotics.com/PSTW and use code PSTW at checkout for 15% off.
Hey, sweetie, your mother showed me this Carvana thing for selling the car. I'm going to give it a try. Wish me luck. Me again. I put in the license plate. It gave me an offer. Unbelievable. Okay, I accepted the offer. They're picking it up Tuesday from the driveway. I haven't even left my chair. It's done. The car is gone. I'm holding a check. Anyway, Carvana, give it a whirl. Love ya.
So good, you'll want to leave a voicemail about it. Sell your car today on
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
Welcome back to Pod Save the World. I'm Tommy Vitor.
I'm Ben Rhodes.
Ben, another Tuesday, another day spent waiting for Trump to make up his mind about what he wants to do in Iran.
Yeah, we had that ceasefire YouTube subscribe to our YouTube channel on Friday, and feels like it wasn't a ceasefire after all. It was just a bunch of Truth Social posts.
Yeah, it was a lot of diplomacy by Truth Social, by tweets. We're going to walk you through all the latest. There's the on-again, off-again diplomatic talks in Pakistan. There's the on-again, off-again closures of the Strait of Hormuz. We're also going to dig into deeper things like what life is like for people in Iran. We'll talk about the latest from Lebanon, including why conservative Christians are not at all thrilled with the Israeli military. I think this is a probably underappreciated story, the degree to which that this image of an IDF soldier smashing a statue of Christ circulated on the internet over the past weekend. Then we're going to talk about corruption and conflicts of interest in the Trump administration and how it's impacting foreign policy.
No.
Yeah.
Really?
Wait till you hear about this Jared Kushner guy. Then we're going to talk about the recent elections in Hungary and Bulgaria, the latest on the administration's like slow rolling regime change-ish efforts in Cuba. Try to figure out what the hell's happening there. Then we are going to update you guys about friend of the show and FBI director, Kash Patel. He's having a good time.
Yeah.
He's having a time in the barrel.
Just throwing back a few beers.
$250 million lawsuit against the Atlantic. We'll see if that goes to court. The discovery on that could be interesting for him. And then, Ben, stick around for my interview with Nick Enrich. He was a top global health official at USAID when Elon Musk and the Doge guys arrived and decided to destroy the entire agency. So he's a new book out called Into the Woodchipper, a whistleblower's account of how the Trump administration shredded USAID. As mad as you are about what Trump has done to the world and all the death and destruction that Elon Musk caused, this will make you even more angry. So I promise
you
that.
Good.
It's worth it.
No, it's this is a story that we shouldn't let just go away because the consequences of it are not going away.
And like, it's one of those, the consequences are growing by the day. I mean, spoiler, the latest count that we talk about in the interview is like 750,000 deaths as a result of USAID being destroyed. But the conversations Nick had with the people in charge of destroying USAID are like absolutely more maddening and stupid than you would think.
You mean Big Balls wasn't a development expert?
Mr. Balls was not a pro on global health or PEPFAR. All right, so let's start with this, what we know about Iran. So as of this recording, the Strait of Hormuz is closed. The war in Iran is not resolved. The talks in Pakistan don't seem to be happening. I mean, we literally are waiting all day. It's like will J.D. Vance get on a plane? That was sort of like the conversation all day in Washington. The president's statements about it all are as incoherent and full of shit as ever. Here are a few examples from an interview Trump did Tuesday morning with CNBC. Let's listen to that.
You need at least the prospects for a signed deal today and tomorrow, or else you would resume bombing Iran.
Well, I expect to be bombing because I think that's a better attitude to go in with, but we're ready to go. I mean, the military is raring to go. You know, they want it to be over immediately, and I just looked at a little chart. World War I, 4 years and 3 months. World War II, 6 years. Korean War, 3 years. Vietnam, 19 years. Iraq, 8 years. I'm 5 months, okay? 5 months. I would have won Vietnam very quickly. Look at Venezuela. I took it over in 45 minutes. It was basically a 45-minute. And by the way, a very strong military country. We can't let traitors like Schumer put pressure on you where they say, we want out. Think how bad that is. I'm negotiating with these people, and they're telling us, we have to get out now, we have to get out now, we have to get now. I want to make a good deal. I'm not going to be rushed. I have all the time in the world. So we've done a great job, and I don't want to be rushed by people that are really treasonous as far as I'm concerned.
So I try to do a little less like media criticism these days, but I feel like one follow-up would have been warranted.
Yes.
On the, hey, I would have won Vietnam and Iraq in a couple of weeks. That seemed like a moment for one.
It's so clear that someone made that chart for him too. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like he just came across a chart.
No.
And I think what he fundamentally doesn't understand is that the consequences, yes, I mean, objectively, the war in Iran has not lasted as long as Vietnam. Congratulations.
Yeah.
You get a gold ribbon, you know.
Lesser disaster.
It doesn't mean that it's not a disaster, but also one of the things I think he's missed in this whole enterprise is that the geopolitical consequences of attacking Iran specifically are actually much bigger in some ways than some of the other wars. I mean, not World War I, but say the war in Afghanistan. You know, I don't mean to minimize that war in any way. Obviously horrifying for the people who lived through it, both in Afghanistan and service members. But Afghanistan wasn't a country of 94 million people that controls the Strait of Hormuz and is a significant supplier of global energy. You know, he is set in motion.
Right.
He's kind of messed with the tectonic plates underneath geopolitics and the global economy with this war. And so he doesn't understand this isn't like something that's measured in like how many months of active conflict there are. It's measured in what are the repercussions of this war going to be, above all for the people that have already, you know, been killed or suffered, but also for the entire global economy.
Yeah, for the global economy, yeah. The kind of thing you think that, you know, CNBC
might ask
up
about.
On.
Yeah,
yeah. Who am I to criticize Joe Kernan? So, like I said, Ben, like we were waiting all day to see if J.D. Vance would make this trip. Just before we started recording, President Trump posted the following message on Truth Social. Based on the fact that the government of Iran is seriously fractured, not unexpectedly so, and upon the request of Field Marshal Asim Munir and Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif of Pakistan, we have been asked to hold our attack on the country of Iran until such time as our leaders and representatives can come up with a unified proposal. I have therefore directed our military to continue the blockade and in all other respects remain ready and able, and will therefore extend the ceasefire until such time as their proposal is submitted and discussions are concluded one way or the other, President Donald J. Trump. So I interpreted this as Trump blinking. He doesn't want to go back to war. The Iranians know that. The Wall Street knows that. Oil traders know that. That's why all the prices are down. But he's also unwilling to lift the U.S. blockade of the Strait of Hormuz, which sounds like it was a precondition to get Iran to agree to come back to the table. Does that sound right to you?
That sounds right to me. I think there's a couple other things happening here. The first is that, first of all, remember he was saying like a week ago that the regime has changed and there are all these wonderful people in charge now?
He's still kind of on that message, by
well,
the way.
Well, it hasn't. And what's happening on the Iranian side is pretty clear to me from the outside, which is that the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, the hardest core element of the regime, they're calling the actual shots, right? They are the ones who've closed the Strait of Hormuz. They're the ones who are collecting the tolls. They're the ones who are firing drones at the Gulf. And so some of these kind of civilian leaders, these political leaders of Iran, may not even be able to deliver you know, what they're negotiating at the table, because the IRGC are the ones that ultimately have to sign off, and they're the hardest of the hardliners.
And they got the big guns.
And they've got the guns.
Literally.
And so, first of all, this is what happens when you kill the leadership of a country, right? Mm-hmm. So they've killed multiple people, not just the Ayatollah. They've killed other people that could have been decision makers because they had more sway with the IRGC. And they've kind of finally settled on this speaker of the Iranian parliament who has some cred with the IRGC. But so on the Iranian side, you've got this split. And the IRGC is like, you know what? We can sense that Trump is afraid of this war. And so why would we make a deal that doesn't get us everything we want? You know, we want sanctions relief. We want the Strait of Hormuz to be a toll road. And, you know, maybe we'll ship out the HEU, the dust, as Trump says, but we probably don't want to make any more concessions on a nuclear program. Why should we? This guy's scared of us. He doesn't want the war. Then Trump doesn't really know what he wants. He just wants to be able to say he won. Clearly, he wants to get, like,
he wants good headlines.
The dust out, which, again, as we've talked about, doesn't change the underlying Iranian nuclear program.
Sprinkle on a toilet seat for Bobby Kennedy.
He just wants something to say he won, but because he doesn't really know why he went to war, he doesn't even know what he's really pushing at the table. You know, before the war, they were pushing ballistic missiles, support for proxies. That's all gone.
Regime change.
We're just regime change. We're
justice for protesters killed.
We're back to the JCPOA negotiation, you know, and so that's all Trump knows. And then the Pakistanis probably don't even know why they're hosting this thing.
They're just happy to be there.
Yeah.
They're just happy to be known.
They, you know, made billions of dollars of investments in Trump and Witkoff's kids' business, you know, crypto business. So this is not the best recipe for de-escalation.
Yeah. So I saw this BBC reporter tweeted that the Iranian delegation was basically ready to come to the negotiating table, but then everything changed over the weekend when the U.S. military fired on an Iranian-flagged cargo ship, according to some Iranian source. And that just blew everything up, and they want the blockade basically lifted. We'll get more into the TikTok of how we got there. But Ben, I've been reading, you know, there's a great Economist piece about the kind of intra-Iranian power struggle that you were just touching on. It's between elected officials, it's between the military, it's between nationalists and Islamists. And the way this kind of played out and manifested in practice was Iran sent 80 officials to the last round of Pakistan talks.
Yeah.
30 of them were deemed decision makers. And I think on a previous episode, we talked about how the Iranian delegation was stacked with experts and expertise and people who had been in negotiations before. And that is definitely like the glass half full version of it. But the glass half empty version was The Economist reported that the Pakistani mediators spent as much time kind of refereeing fights between members of the Iranian delegation as facilitating talks with the U.S. So, yes, it does sound like there's a very real power struggle happening and no clear way that it ends besides, you know, the military probably killing a bunch of people or throwing them in prison.
Yeah. I mean, some of this is also probably like you want to go to Pakistan. It's been a little rough in Iran.
It's true.
Probably sounds nice to be in a hotel with good Wi-Fi and like all you can eat breakfast buffet, you know.
It's a good point.
The other thing I would say is, and this gets to the True Social post, when I was, you know, in charge of, for lack of a better term, like, you know, advocating for the Iran deal, there was a dynamic that would happen where, look, obviously we were trying to emphasize all that we got in the deal. So we would lean into like, you know, they're going to submit to these intrusive inspections and they're going to ship out the stockpile and we're going to be able to see all of their program, the uranium mines and mills and the centrifuges, all true. But sometimes John Kerry would get a call from Javad Zarif, the foreign minister, who'd be like, hey, can you guys kind of
chill out
a bit on the intrusive inspections piece? Because it's true, but the IRGC, I mean, he didn't necessarily say in these words, but basically it was giving him problems with the hardliners back home, right? The IRGC didn't want the deal, or they didn't like aspects of the deal, like the intrusive inspections where you could just show up and look at stuff. And so it hurt him in the Iranian system if we were leaning into that. Imagine if you were the Iranian negotiator, and you're probably out in front of the IRGC a little bit in Pakistan. And you're like, well, yeah, maybe we could ship the dust out in exchange for this. And you have to sell it back home to these killers in the IRGC. And then all of a sudden you wake up on a Friday and Trump is True Social posting all these concessions that you actually didn't make.
Yeah.
The strait will be open forever, which is, you know, not something that I'm sure the Iranians agreed to, that they're not going to enrich uranium.
Right.
Trump was posting that. The IRGC guys, I guarantee you, called up the negotiators and were like, what the fuck? And hey, maybe come pay a visit to us, you know? It's like, And so, of course, they're like backing out because they don't want to get killed by the IRGC. And so Trump is literally endangering the negotiators by what he's doing. I can sense that.
It's a good strategy. No, it makes a lot of sense. Okay, so let's do a bit of the tale of the tape about how we got to this point. And like you said earlier, we recorded a bonus episode for the Pod Save the World YouTube on Friday about this like flurry of social media activity. So please subscribe to Pod Save the World on YouTube to make sure you don't miss any of these bonus episodes. And also when you subscribe and you like and you share the stuff we do on YouTube, you help us get people good information when they're just searching for what the hell is happening with the Iran talks and not factual, not like propaganda. Because Ben, I made the mistake of watching a clip of Hugh Hewitt on his show interviewing Eli Lake about the latest on the ceasefire talks. It was like a parallel universe where everything was solved. The war was a triumph. They'd figured it all out. So
how do those guys live with the reality that that's not true?
They do a lot of dust, you know, a lot of that.
If Obama had done this, they'd be yelling about how we let the regime in place, how they left the ballistic missiles. Anyway.
Yeah. So, okay. Last week, we get this flurry of claims from Trump on social media. You mentioned a few of them, but let me just read them. Iran has agreed to never close the Strait of Hormuz again. It will no longer be used as a weapon against the world. Not sure that one held up. The USA will get all nuclear dust created by our great B-2 bombers. No money will exchange hands in any way, shape, or form. And then finally he said, Israel will not be bombing Lebanon any longer. They are prohibited, all caps, from doing so by the USA. That one I liked. So it was all bullshit. Iran had only announced a partial opening of the strait. And then by Saturday, they'd walked back even that partial opening because the Iranians were pissed that Trump said, well, we're going to continue our blockade of the strait. Then things escalated further after the Iranians attacked two Indian flagships attempting to transit the strait. Trump called those attacks a total violation of our ceasefire agreement. And then he re-upped his threat to destroy Iran's civilization, its civilian infrastructure, by saying, you know, if they don't take the deal, the United States is going to knock out every single power plant, every single bridge in Iran. No more Mr. Nice Guy, all caps, is how we've ended that one. The U.S. later boarded and seized an Iranian vessel that was en route from China. The U.S. seized a tanker in the Indian Ocean. So things just kept escalating. On Monday, Iran's Speaker of the Parliament and lead negotiator, Mohammad Ghalibaf, said Iran will, quote, not accept negotiations under the shadow of threats, and, quote, we have been preparing to show new cards in the battlefield. So always excited for like
the new cards,
you know, mid-season twist here. Yeah. So, Ben, obviously, my working assumption has been that Trump wants a deal or he wants the war over. He wants to punt this as far down the road as he possibly can and just do CNBC hits and convince a bunch of commodities traders,
meathead traders,
that he is in fact going to fold on everything and taco, whatever you want to call it, and just like not make their lives harder, not increase the oil of energy. But also he refuses to admit that he hasn't accomplished all of his goals. There will be people pushing him from the right to actually get the HEU. Like, I have zero doubt, I have zero hope that the Israelis will actually adhere to this demand that they never attack.
And they're still in Lebanon.
Lebanon again, and they're still occupying Lebanon. We'll get into all the details of that later. So, I don't know, man, like, this is as clear as mud, but like, how do you see this playing out in this moment?
I think if you look at the Iranians, they know they don't have to give much, you know. In some ways, they could choose to give nothing, and the war just kind of freezes. I think what they want, though, is money. You know, they want either unfrozen assets, like, you know, we heard rumors of $20 billion. They want either, you know, probably more comprehensive sanctions relief so they can just sell oil without it being sanctioned. They want to tax the Strait of Hormuz in perpetuity. They just want revenue, you know. And what will they trade to get that? They will not trade away their ballistic missile program because they've just demonstrated how much they need it. They're not going to trade away their support for proxies because it's kind of existential to them that they have these proxies. And they're not going to say that they'll never enrich uranium. They're not going to say we won't have a nuclear program. So I think what they had to trade away is the dust, you know, because the dust is not frankly, that important.
Which isn't just isn't dust, by
it's
the way.
Dust. It's enriched uranium. It's containers. It's highly enriched uranium. Like, it's so weird that it's, so funny we have to call it dust because he has to say that he obliterated the program. But anyway,
yeah.
Because fundamentally, that means nothing to them. They still have centrifuges that they can operate. If they choose to, you know, have a covert nuclear program, they just take those centrifuges underground and accumulate more dust, you know? So I could kind of see some deal where they ship out the HEU and, I don't know, maybe they promise not to enrich uranium for some period of time, which, by the way, that promise is worth nothing, absent, like, rigorous inspections, which I don't think they're going to submit to, right? And so then Trump says he got the deal of the century. It's so much better than Obama's Iran deal, even though it's going to be probably a lesser version of the Iran deal, and it'll be like the dust for some sanctions relief, you know, and the war's over.
For 15 years instead of 10 or something.
And if you think about it, yeah, but it'll be a phony. They can say 100, you know, like they've learned that deals are fungible. They've learned that, you know, so to them, any deal they make is a deal for the duration of the Trump presidency.
Right.
It's a 2.5-year deal, and they'll reassess at that point. Or maybe they'll just cheat and have a covert nuclear program. And so you could see this world in which Trump declares victory because he got the dust out. In the Strait of Hormuz that was open before the war is open. Again, measure that against what he said at the beginning of the war. There's going to be regime change. We're going to obliterate, you know, their nuclear program. We have to end their ballistic missile program. We're going to destroy their navy. Well, clearly we haven't destroyed their navy because they've closed the Strait of Hormuz with like a bunch of speedboats, you know? So he's not achieved the things he said he would. And it was totally unnecessary to launch this war, kill all these people, upend the entire global economy, you know, permanently lose the Gulf states, you know, as people that are reliant on the United States, and on and on and on. Was all that worth it to get like the dust out? You know, does anybody in America even care about the dust?
Which,
you know?
By the way, had already been dusted as far as we were concerned, based on Trump's claims.
Well, and the question is, and I have a question for you, Tommy, is like, this is a Hugh Hewitt question, is like, will the right wingers accept? Because that's a total capitulation to the Iranians.
Yeah, I think that where they're, what they will tell themselves, the story they'll tell themselves is, look, he destroyed all of, you know, Isfahan. He destroyed all the nuclear facilities. It will take a generation to build them back. They have no revenue. The military capacity is, a fraction of what it once was. Therefore, that is some big win when it's like what everyone has always said about military efforts to shut down Iran's nuclear program. It's like you can set them back, but you cannot permanently take it away or solve the problem. And I think they'll convince themselves that the problem has been, you know, as solved as much as it could have been, when I think we know in reality there could be like a garage somewhere in Iran with some nuclear centrifuges spinning that's enriching, uranium to the grade they need it to be.
They're just in this fantasy world where this is a game of risk. Because I think the most important thing we've learned from this war is that the demonstrated capacity of the Iranians to close the Strait of Hormuz is worth 10,000 ballistic missiles. It's worth far more than support for Hezbollah, you know, like, and they can't, whatever capabilities Iran lost, they gained a much bigger one in showing that just firing a few drones at some tankers and threatening to the Strait of Hormuz gives them control of the global economy. So congratulations, Hugh Hewitt and Eli Lake. You've just empowered the IRGC more than anything that has happened since the 1979 revolution.
Another Trump win.
Except for maybe the Iraq War, which empowered them significantly. So this is the second time
another big win
that
for the
neocons have given the IRGC a gigantic win.
This episode of Pod Save the World is brought to you by Wild Grain. Wild Grain is the first bake from frozen subscription box for sourdough breads, artisanal pastries, and fresh pastas. Unlike many store-bought options, Wild Grain uses simple ingredients you can pronounce and a slow fermentation process that can be easier on your belly and richer in nutrients and antioxidants. Plus, all items conveniently bake in 25 minutes or less with no thawing required. Wild Grain's boxes are fully customizable. In addition to their variety box, they have a gluten-free box, a vegan box, and a new protein box. I love Wild Grain. It's really fun. It's really great with kids because it just feels special. You can pull something out of the freezer. You can make a bunch of like pain du chocolat. I love it. Loves when I do a little French accent.
I love your French
croissant.
And would it help me in that Hims ad?
Tastes It tastes way, way better than anything that you're going to like pull off a shelf. It's cooks in like, you know, 10, 15, 20 minutes. It does not take long. And it just feels special. It's a lot of fun. We loved it. My kids loved it. I highly recommend it. Imagine having fresh bakery quality bread, pastries, and pasta at home without any trips to the store. Don't just take my word for it. They have over 40,000 five-star reviews and have been voted the best food subscription box by USA Today 3 years in a row. For a limited time, Wild Grain is offering our listeners $30 off your first box, plus free croissants for life when you go to wildgrain.com/world to start your subscription today. That's $30 off your first box and free croissants for life when you visit wildgrain.com/world, or you can use the promo code WORLD at checkout. Pod Save the World is brought to you by Quince. This time of year might make you rethink what's in your closet. You want to move away from clutter towards high-quality pieces you can actually live in. That's why you should check out Quince. The fabrics feel elevated, the fits are thoughtful, and the pricing actually makes sense too. Quince makes high-quality everyday essentials using premium materials. Their 100% European linen parts and shirts for men are lightweight, breathable, and comfortable, basically the perfect layer for spring. The pants strike the right balance between laid back and refined, so you look put together without trying too hard. And their flow-knit activewear, moisture-wicking, anti-odor, and soft enough that you'll actually want to wear it all day. And the best part is their prices are 50 to 60% less than similar brands. How? Quince works directly with ethical factories and cuts out the middlemen, so you're paying for quality, not brand markup. Everything is designed to last and make getting dressed easy. I have bought a bunch of stuff from Quince. I bought some basics, some t-shirts, some socks, things like that.
Great sheets, too. Great
nice
stuff.
Yeah, they have tons of nice stuff. I think I've said before, I bought a bunch of folks, Christmas presents from Quince. Some, they have some really, really nice sweaters that were cashmere, that were really nice, but also affordable, that everybody loved. I got to check out their spring gear because it's almost summertime here in LA. Time to do a little refresh. You know, everyone I think probably has a closet where you have 10 things and you wear three of them and there's no reason for the other seven to sit around. So get rid of the crap. Replace it with Quince. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Go to quince.com/world for free shipping and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. Go to quince.com/world for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/world. One group that didn't get a win here is the Iranian people. No. Let's talk about what life is like for them right now to the best we can. So the estimate you see in terms of civilian casualties in Iran is about 1,700 people. I think we should assume that that's a massive undercount. But that would only be the direct death toll, and that is far from the only impact. So the Center for American Progress put together a report that talks about the kind of the human environmental costs of the war. That includes the U.S. and Israeli airstrikes that release these toxic chemicals and pollutants into the air. Remember when the Israelis bombed this big petrochemical facility? It was like, you know, they're, it was raining like acid for days on people, right? So God knows what that did to civilians. There have been, you know, further erosions of Iran's healthcare infrastructure, which is already under enormous stress before the war because of anti-government protests and decades of sanctions and mismanagement. And then Iran was experiencing this massive water shortage again before the war. That has gotten worse because, you know, at least one of their desalination plants was bombed. And then on top of that, Ben, so the Iranians have dealt with like an almost total internet blackout since the war started. And I would just ask anyone, like, imagine any modern economy running without an internet for 2 months.
Yeah.
It's impossible.
Every business
is screwed. Right. And so on top of that, you know, you got the US and Israel targeting major industries like petrochemical and steel. You need those industries to rebuild the country and also to get the revenue to rebuild the country. I saw one analyst told the Wall Street Journal that the disruption to the steel industry put at risk more than 5.5 million jobs within Iran, and then another 1.2 million at risk because of impacts on the chemical and pharma industry. And so, like, again, to sum it all up, there were all these protesters who Trump said he was going to rescue, who are now like staring down the barrel of a more hardline regime. Right. They traded the older Khamenei for the younger Khamenei. The IRGC is more entrenched and life is just exponentially worse for them. Right? A disastrous economic situation somehow got worse because we bombed the shit out of it.
Yeah, I think that we live in this world in which, you know, our news cycle focuses on this place when the bombs are falling. And then, you know, it's same impulse as Trump. Trump kind of reflects the worst aspects of America. It's a common thread with Trump. If I can just get this off the television set, you know, and actually to him, it's the television set. For most of us, it's our phones. Then, you know, we'll think about other things. We'll think about, I don't know, the ballroom or the next war against Cuba or whatever. But I think what you're reminding us is of the people inside of Iran, like this war is going to be with them for a very long time. It's going to show up in, you know, the deeper poverty, deeper repression, maybe health effects of some of these things that have been done, that millions of people will, and actually millions of Iranians were also displaced, you know, millions of people's lives are worse because of what Donald Trump did. And that's the kind of moral outrage that's sometimes missing, you know, when people talk about like democratic opposition to the war, that's about like, he didn't ask Congress the right way. Or right. Like, what about the fact that like,
about the briefing?
Yeah, he just fucked over like millions of Iranians and
in perpetuity,
Gulf
by the way.
Arabs and Lebanese and the U.S. Civil Service members who died or were wounded, their lives are never going to be the same. And I think we kind of have to remind ourselves of that human cost. I think the other thing that'll be interesting is, you know, there's a world in which protests resume. You know, life is shitty there. But the IRGC is now like more dug in. They frankly think that they just weathered. If we can weather Trump bombing us and the Israelis bombing us, we can deal with these protesters.
Definitely.
And there's less of a threat of the United States bombing again.
Yep.
Like if they're cracking down and killing thousands of protesters at some future date, you know, they probably think, well, Trump doesn't want to get another war. And I think the other thing that's happened, I'd be curious, and we won't know until we ask, you know, actual Iranians, which is hard because internet blackout, among other things. These diaspora Iranians that were very supportive of the war, like Reza Pahlavi, who was calling on people to rise up and suggesting he was going to go run a transition, those people have to be pretty discredited because—
Oh, you would think. Well, you and I talked about this. Yeah. I mean, people who push for wars and the wars go badly are almost never discredited in Washington, so I'm sure he'll have a friend there.
Yeah, he'll have a friend in Washington, but
within,
I mean—
Within Iran.
Again, sure. He told these people that he was going to run some transition. Trump cast him aside, the same way he did Maria Machado in Venezuela. So it'll be interesting to see how the diaspora kind of adjusts to this, because I think there's a lot of splits. The people that advocated for this now look like they just advocated for something horrible to happen to their country. I'm not suggesting that's what they wanted to happen, but that is what happened.
But that's what happened.
So I think, by every metric, life is worse for Iranians.
And there's just no time frame for building it back. I mean, Iranian state media put the cost of rebuilding Iran at $270 billion.
Yeah.
Where is that money going to come from? Yeah. And even over in the UAE, the Wall Street Journal reported that the Trump administration is considering basically a bailout for the UAE because their economy has been hit so hard. So like the entire Gulf is feeling this ripple out. And so Ben, like maybe the best news we have for you guys today, at least in this kind of bucket, is that the ceasefire is mostly holding in Lebanon. On Friday, Trump posted on Truth Social, like we mentioned earlier, Israel will not be bombing Lebanon any longer. They are prohibited from doing so by the USA. Enough is enough. Axios reported that this caught the Israelis by surprise and that Netanyahu was, quote, personally stunned and alarmed by the message. It's nice. Take that one. Trump later elaborated to Axios, saying Israel has to stop. They can't continue to blow buildings up. I'm not going to allow it. Again, I'm very skeptical that will hold. But God, I would have loved to hear Joe Biden say that one fucking time about Gaza over the course of 2 years. Anyway, the IDF, though, is still occupying a huge chunk of southern Lebanon. The IDF calls it a forward defense line. We should call it what it is, which is Israel invading and occupying another country. A bunch of Lebanese people use the ceasefire to return to their villages and just check out their homes. They found them destroyed, in many cases flattened to the ground by U.S. military-provided bulldozers. Last week, 40 Democrats voted to block the sale of military bulldozers to Israel because they're using for this kind of stuff. But unfortunately, that vote failed. Folks on social media over the weekend, Ben, might have seen this pretty shocking image of an IDF soldier literally sledgehammering the face of a statue of Jesus Christ on the cross. This happened in a Christian town in southern Lebanon. When I first saw this image, I thought it must have been AI generated because it looked designed in a lab to inflame sectarian tensions and erode support for Israel among evangelicals. But nope, turns out it was real. In a statement, notably a statement released in English, Netanyahu said he was stunned and saddened by the soldier's actions, and he condemned the act in the strongest terms. So the soldier who vandalized the statue and the soldier who took the picture were removed from combat duty and sentenced to 30-day military detentions. But there were six others on the scene who were going to be punished separately, probably get a slap on the wrist or something. We'll find out. But the damage was done. This incident outraged conservatives, outraged religious leaders. It's not an isolated incident. Folks probably remember that the only Catholic church in Gaza was shelled a couple different times, and the priest there was wounded in one of those shellings. So, Ben, we've talked before on the show about how Israel's biggest supporters in the U.S. are not American Jews. It's evangelical Christians who, like, want the rapture to come. Do you think these stories will kind of will dent that support? Because you do see this narrative get lifted up by Tucker Carlson a lot, for example.
I think so. I mean, first of all, I'm dubious of this ceasefire. One statistic I saw, Tommy, was that, you know, there was a ceasefire with Hezbollah in late 2024 that was reached. And the UN, the UN force in Lebanon, reported 10,000 Israeli violations of that ceasefire.
That doesn't seem good.
Before this latest war started.
Yeah, that's not a
lot. And we saw the same thing in Gaza. Israel's violated the ceasefire in Gaza hundreds, if not thousands, yes, of times. And so what they do is what Trump wants is, again, Trump doesn't really care about the people in Lebanon or Gaza. He wants it to be a low enough level of violence that it's just kind of not leading the news, you know? And so if Israel's like occasionally bombing Lebanon in perpetuity, that's fine as long as it's not like the big show where they were, you know,
right,
obliterating Beirut. So count me skeptical about the directives to Netanyahu to, you know, prohibit him from doing this in Lebanon. On the Christian stuff, I think that the problem for Trump and Israel is that there's a bunch of converging things happening. Is that you have, yes, like in Lebanon, these are some of these villages that are being destroyed are Christian villages. Some of them are Christian, like, you know, they have lineage that goes back to like the Bible, you know, like the New Testament. Like, mm-hmm, this is the Holy Land, you know, for Christians. Like, this is where this war is happening, where Israel's occupying territory. And some of the people, the priests have been killed in the bombing. I saw, you know, a child that had met with the Pope was killed in the bombing. Like, there are these different things that are you know, touching this space. When you add on top of that, Trump posting the picture of himself as Jesus, and Trump, you know, putting out this, you know, threat to annihilate, you know, Iran on Easter morning, you know, Happy, mm-hmm, Easter. There's a disrespect and disregard for Christianity in both the actions of the Israeli government and in the personal actions of Trump. And so the evangelical Christians are having a double reckoning because they're both like, huh, Trump, I thought we liked him. He got rid of Roe v. Wade, but it turns out he's mocking Jesus.
Now he seems like the Antichrist.
And huh, like, I, you know, I thought Israel was our friend, but they're blowing up, you know, Christian villages. And now there's this, you know, picture of an Israeli IDF soldier, like, desecrating Jesus.
Of all the things to post on social media, you take literally taking a sledgehammer to Jesus's face. Yeah, yeah. What are you thinking? What are your hobbies? What does that guy's feed like?
It does show you the impunity. I mean, you see this sometimes on IDF social media. Like,
yeah,
remember when it used to be the most moral army in the world? I guess that talking points out.
And there was another incident, I think, in a church in southern Lebanon where a bunch of IDF soldiers like staged a fake wedding inside an Orthodox church and probably didn't realize like how profoundly offensive that was for a bunch of, yeah, Christians in that community. And that went super viral on social media. So like people who, again, whose feeds push them this kind of content have seen example after example after example, and are now like this whole most moral army thing has just been tossed out the window. And we're not even, yeah, talking about,
yeah,
the disrespect and treatment to Muslims, Palestinians, your average sort of like Lebanese person. Like that is unfortunately, yeah, priced in.
Well, and you also remember the Israeli government closed on Palm Sunday.
Yes,
the Church of the Holy Sepulchre.
Yeah, like, to the highest representative of the Vatican. In,
yeah, literally where Jesus was born. You, yeah, know? So I think that, look, it is the case that a lot of Americans and American Christians actually probably didn't know until a few months ago that there's a huge Palestinian Christian community that includes and encompasses the most holy sites in the Christian church, you,
yeah,
know,
yeah,
Bethlehem. And Tucker Carlson, people like that are now really, you know, hitting on that point. And so I think it does risk lowering the floor of support for both Israel and Trump because, you know, people who actually care about their Christian faith are going to be upset about this. It also is a very dangerous gateway to a certain kind of anti-Semitism that is one of the older kinds of anti-Semitism. Well, the Jews are the ones who killed Jesus.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. And it's very dangerous.
And again, like, it's Trump and Bibi that, you know, it doesn't just justify it in any way. It shows why these kinds of wars are so dangerous for anti-Semitism, you know, because they lead people in those directions.
Yeah. And again, like the cost to civilians on the ground in Lebanon has been unbearable, right? I mean, there's the direct casualty number, but then there's the million people who have been displaced and the people who came back to their homes that have just been leveled. We reached out to Doctors Without Borders to see kind of what they're experiencing on the ground in Lebanon. And we got this note from an emergency physician, Dr. Tianmin Din. Let's listen.
I need people to understand what the injuries looked like that we were seeing before the ceasefire. Now, beyond the acute injuries, we're looking at a generation left with lifelong disabilities. I visited a young woman a few days ago in ICU who we treated when she came through the emergency department. She'd been walking along with a friend when both her legs were blown off. She managed to survive her initial injuries, but when I visited her a couple of days ago, she was hooked up to dialysis because the muscle destruction from her injury was so extensive that it had started destroying her kidneys. I also recently visited a migrant woman who'd been a patient at a clinic for years. She was injured in one of the very first strikes in the south, and she's still in the hospital. She's bled into her brainstem and spine. She's paralyzed. Her home is destroyed, and the people who would have cared for her were killed in the same strike. We are also seeing an overwhelming number of people whose health needs were neglected during the war, either because they couldn't reach healthcare or their doctors were displaced, or hospitals had to shut their outpatient clinics to direct resources to trauma and emergency care. Yesterday, our clinic diagnosed a young pregnant woman with a baby who had died in utero. Imagine having a fully formed, wanted, and loved baby and having its heart stopped because the healthcare system had collapsed. These are complications that if they get caught early, they can be treated, they can be delivered safely by C-section when there's a functioning system. But there isn't one.
So, you often hear people say, well, you know, the IDF military campaign in Lebanon is the most justified of all their actions because there is this real threat from Hezbollah and from rockets, et cetera. And it's like, okay, but there is a flip side to that argument about the human cost for people living in Lebanon who have no association with Hezbollah, probably hate them. And that's some examples right there.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that strikes me listening to that clip is these people in Doctors Without Borders, they've been in a lot of difficult places. And you could hear her voice like breaking.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing we experience in Gaza. Like, the scale of this destruction is not normal even for a war. Because you hear it in her voice, like the things that are happening kind of go beyond there was a civilian casualty event, you know. Because again, this gets at why is it necessary to go after the health infrastructure if you're targeting Hezbollah? Like, it just clearly this war went well beyond targeting Hezbollah. Either because there was no targeting, or because it was indiscriminate, or because there was really an objective to kind of paralyze Lebanese society while you take southern Lebanon. Now, the other thing I want to say, Tommy, and I'm going to say this at the beginning, many thanks to the Worldo, Lebanese American, who sent me some wonderful Lebanese olive oil.
Okay.
Because, you know, she was...
It's not the swerve I was expecting.
Grateful for our coverage of Lebanon. But actually, the reason I make this point, beyond just thanking that person, is... The Lebanese I know hate that their country is only seen as like this war zone. Like
right. It's like this beautiful cosmopolitan city.
Yeah, if it's on the news, it's because Hezbollah and, you know, rubble in Beirut.
Right.
And what the olive oil reminds me of, this is this incredible place.
One of the prettiest places
it's
on the
one
planet.
Of the, yeah, it's this gorgeous country. They produce wonderful things. They have wonderful artists. I mean, it's worth naming this because... There's something dehumanizing about how we kind of like, you know, the camera only turns on these places to show like rubble and then a commentator talking about Hezbollah, you know, like it's like the vast majority of Lebanese, including Shia Muslims, are not like Hezbollah operatives, you know,
just normal human beings.
Beirut is usually like an incredibly cosmopolitan city, not just a bunch of rubble from Israeli bombs, you know? Yeah. And so the erasure of the humanity of people cannot be a consequence of the war.
Yeah. And it doesn't have to be this way. It's a bunch of political choices made by political leaders. All right, let's turn to just the broader problem within the administration of the failure of diplomacy and the role I think you and I both believe that corruption has played in all of it. So Trump, when he has a diplomatic problem, he does not send experts, as we've discussed. He sends his idiot son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and his idiot golf buddy, Steve Witkoff. And the issue is not just that they're in over their heads, which they are. They very much are. It's that they are corrupt. They have these huge financial conflicts of interest, and we basically have no visibility into the specifics or how those conflicts of interest might impact their decision-making. Especially, we're talking about the Middle East, right? And Jared Kushner's got all this golf money. So let's just go through the examples, because we've talked about this before, but I don't know if we've done like a comprehensive kind of like corruption conversation recently. So Kushner is this floating envoy. He meets with the Board of Peace. He meets with the Russians. He meets with the Iranians. He's in Gaza all the time. He's talking to the Israelis. And the White House, they talk about Jared like in this role, he's making this big sacrifice because he doesn't take like the White House salary.
Yeah.
And don't, for those who might have been, who might believe this bullshit, Jared is an unpaid volunteer because volunteers don't have to make ethics disclosures and release their you know, personal financial disclosure forms. So we only know because of previous press reports that Jared's investment firm, Affinity Partners, got $2 billion from the Saudis, and he got hundreds of millions more from the Emiratis and the Qataris. We also know that at the World Economic Forum in Davos earlier this year, Jared was ostensibly there as Trump's Middle East envoy, but he was also soliciting funds for his firm. The New York Times said Jared was trying to raise another $5 billion for his fund. I assume most of that would come from the Saudis if he had his druthers. Bloomberg reported that 99% of all Affinity Partners' assets belong to non-U.S. investors. So that's the little we know about Jared. Eric and Don Jr. recently announced they're going to work for a drone manufacturing company, which later merged with a publicly traded Trump company that owns golf courses. So that makes a lot of sense, Ben, is totally on the up and up. Forbes estimated that from 2024 to 2025, Don Jr.'s net worth went from $50 million to $300 million. Eric's went from $40 million to $750 million. And Barron Trump, who is a college sophomore, is estimated by Forbes to be worth $150 million, all of it tied to cryptocurrency stuff. And then finally, Ben, I know you've heard of Truth Social. But did you know that its revenue does not just come from spammy ads for mail order brides and Chinese peptides and things of that nature? They also, we'll do it a little multiple choice game here. What business did Trump Media, the owner of Truth Social, get into recently via a $6 billion merger? Was it A, Orbital Data Centers, B, Fusion Energy, C, Non-Woke AI, D, Anti-Woke Legal Services via its acquisition of Liberty Legal, which is an anti-woke legal services company for patriots who don't want their case law to be totally gay.
All right. So I in my mind, it's probably Orbital Data Centers or Non-Woke AI. And I'm going to go with Non-Woke AI.
Sorry, my friend, it's Fusion Energy.
Really?
Yes. Yes. The Trumps recently got into the fusion energy business. The conflicts of interest are so massive. The media barely covers them. Do you see the reporting the other day that's like Jared Kushner's conflicts are barely mentioned in the
that
reporting?
Was a good, yeah.
And it's like, this is harming our national security and it's kind of just not part of the conversation.
First of all, we should say there is a highly evolved network of corruption between kind of Russia, the Gulf, the U.S. far right kind of MAGAverse, Hungary. There's just a lot of money that kind of swashes around this space. And what's interesting is Jared gravitates to all the places that are the most corrupt.
Yeah, interesting how that works.
So, huh? You know, the hotel deals in Serbia, like probably one of the most corrupt countries in Europe and an extension of Russian interests in a lot of ways. Or obviously he's vacuuming up money in the Gulf. Pakistan, as I mentioned, has a partnership with World Liberty Financial, controlled by Trump and Witkoff kids, to launch a stable coin, right? And so that's why else are the talks in Pakistan? You know,
right.
So the point is that Jared is negotiating issues that are directly related to the interests of these countries that are paying him in the countries that are paying, if not him, his family members, and is simultaneously raising funds for his business while he's negotiating. And I think what is so grotesque about this is sure, like in some ways, this is kind of how business is done in parts of the world. Like there's a lot of corruption. You know, there's some big commercial deal and there's some money that exchanges hands under the table. But what Jared is leveraging is literally the U.S. military. Like the U.S. military is an instrument of his corruption. Mm-hmm. Our capacity to sell weapons to the Gulf countries or to protect the Gulf countries or to go to war with the opponents of the Gulf countries is directly related to both his diplomatic portfolio and probably the reason they're writing checks. And so it's just a higher scale corruption because he's not trading like small. It's not like, hey, like, you know, we're going to do a soybean deal and I'm going to get some money under the table. Or Hunter Biden, I'm going to get a $50,000 a month retainer from Burisma to sit on their board and hopefully get influence to the big guy, Joe Biden. No, this is like billions of dollars that are being paid because he has the power of the U.S. government behind him. And it is a shame on the U.S. media that they don't name that should be in the first paragraph of every story.
It should be. It has to be.
And not for like partisan reasons, because like, how are you informing your readers?
Tell people why.
Yeah. Why is Jared at the table?
Why is he at the table? Why are these talks failing? Why do we keep reading that like Jared and Steve Witkoff didn't understand the substance of the nuclear negotiation? Oh, right. They're not nuclear scientists. They're there because of corruption. And like Steve Witkoff's son, Zach, is the co-founder of World Liberty Financial, the crypto firm. That like, It sounds like a big scam or a Ponzi scheme. Like, you know who's mad at World Liberty Financial recently, Ben, is Justin Sun. Remember that crypto billionaire that pumped billions into World Liberty Financial? Wow, what a coincidence. Right at the same time, the SEC investigation into one of his companies went away, and now he's accusing them of fraud.
This
guy's attacking World Liberty Financial. The Qataris gave Trump the plane. There's the real estate deals all across the world. And you got like, you know, remember what was it? The Gaza peace agreement event when some world leader is like, hey, Trump, can I get Don or Eric's phone numbers?
The president of Indonesia, one of the biggest countries in the world, is like, hey, can I get Eric Trump's phone number? What do you think that's about? To get his advice about how to deal with development in Aceh and Indonesia? Like, no. I mean, and this is all like just happening on the open. I mean, one thing I've heard you guys begin to talk on PSA about, you know, the Project 2029, like what happens if Democrats win? Like the accountability goes so far beyond Donald Trump Sr. You know, like, The combination of the fraud and crimes that are being committed and also the need to have laws that prevent this kind of corruption is got to be like one of the first spate of executive orders from a Democratic president.
Totally agree. And Trump also got rid of all the inspector generals at all the agencies that might be providing like watchdogs of this. They closed the DOJ kleptocracy task force. They stopped enforcing FARA, which is the Foreign Agent Registration Act, which is trying to prevent like, you know, foreign agents from buying influence in Washington. There's been a bunch of reporting recently about this friend of Trump's from like the 80s and 90s named Paolo Zampoli. Have you read about this guy? Fucking guy, man.
The one who narked on his ex-wife or something to ICE?
Dude was boys with Trump in like the 80s and 90s. He was, I think, a modeling agent. Now Trump made him the special envoy of the President of the United States for Global Partnership.
Has a very Epstein ring to...
Yeah, we're buddies with Epstein. Yeah. And he told the FT, whatever people see me, they want something. They want access to the president. I tell them, buy Boeing. If you want to make the president happy, buy Boeing. It's the simplest thing in the world. It's like... just talking about access trading.
Can we say one other thing about this, which is that the stock market, it's been extraordinary to watch this, first of all, because there's an irrationality. You see it kind of going up. Part of the problem is Trump looks at that as a useful metric. There's two problems. One is clearly someone is doing massive insider trading. And there's been the BBC has a great investigation people should look at that they've accounted for all these trades before Trump makes an announcement of people essentially, you know, betting on Trump making that announcement and making hundreds of millions of dollars. And it's happened repeatedly on both Iran and
like
on tariff
15 minutes before Truth Social posts.
And so somebody is clearly profiting. But the other thing is the market is just a bullshit indicator for how the economy is going for people.
Right.
Because it's a bunch of fucking traders sitting in front of computer screens, betting on currencies, betting on the price of oil. So even if, you know, you're going to get fucked and there are going to be oil scarcities and your gas prices are going to go up. They can still make a ton of money on trades by just betting where the currencies are going to go.
And, well, and the prices we're all seeing reported daily in the news are like futures prices usually, which are, which often are less than the actual price of a barrel of oil. If you were to like pull up to Kuwait and like throw one in the back of your truck.
It's just such, the whole thing is corrupt. Capitalism has kind of reached its late stage Frankenstein monster, you know, where it's just a vehicle for people like this to grift off of us, you know.
No, I think it's great that we're betting on when Maduro is going to be deposed. Some insider can make hundreds of thousands of dollars on Kalshi.
Some, you can be a Trump insider. You can be like a, you know, a special force. I'm not trying to pun them, but like,
of course,
you shouldn't have that.
There's a lot of people.
Yeah, a lot of people know when things are going to happen and they can make money off it.
Yeah. All right. Well, that was nice to get that off our chest. By the way, if you guys want to support a media company that will always report on Jared Kushner's corruption and the Witkoff family's corruption, please consider becoming a Friend of the Pod subscriber. Go to crooked.com/friends. You can subscribe. You get ad-free episodes. You get lots of bonus content. And you also help us build an independent progressive media company that can help hold this administration accountable. Pod Save the World is brought to you by Hims. At some point, you stop blaming stress, sleep, or just getting older. Mm. Bedroom performance is in question. It's probably crossed your mind to do something about it. The good news, you don't have to jump through hoops to fix it. Hims connects you with licensed healthcare providers online, giving you simple access to legitimate ED treatment options from home. No awkward appointments, no pharmacy lines. Just complete a simple online intake and a provider will review your information and determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your treatment ships directly to your door in discreet packaging. That includes sildenafil, which is also known as a generic for Viagra, which is available through Hims at up to 95% less than the brand name version. And if that option isn't right for you, there are additional treatment options available so you can find what works for your body. It's straightforward, transparent, and designed to make getting care feel easy. To get simple online access to personalized, affordable care for ED, hair loss, weight loss, and more, visit hims.com/world. That's hims.com/world for your free online visit, hims.com/world. Prescription requires, see website for details and important safety information. Sildenafil is a generic version of Viagra. Viagra is a registered trademark of Viatris Specialty LLC. Hims is not affiliated with or endorsed by Viatris. Pod Save the World is brought to you by Fast Growing Trees. Did you know that Fast Growing Trees is America's largest and most trusted online nursery with thousands of trees and plants and over 2 million happy customers? They have all the plants your yard or home needs, including fruit trees, privacy trees, flowering trees, shrubs, and houseplants, all grown with care and guaranteed to arrive healthy. Whatever you're looking for, Fast Growing Trees helps you find options that actually work for your climate and your space and your lifestyle. Fast Growing Trees makes it easy to get your dream yard. Just click, order, and grow. And get healthy, thriving plants delivered to your door. Their Alive and Thrive guarantee promises that your plants arrive happy and healthy. No green thumb required, just quality plants you can count on. Plus, get ongoing support from trained plant experts who can help you plan your landscape, choose the right plants, and learn how to care for them every step of the way. Fast Growing Trees is a great idea because I think everybody wants to have some greenery in the house or something nice in the yard or some nice landscaping, but nobody knows how to do it. I don't know what works in the climate and place I live. I don't know what looks good in my house. I don't know how to keep this shit alive, but the people at Fast Growing Trees will help you. They'll collect you with an expert and make it super, super easy. And then the plants you get, they'll show up on time, they'll be affordable, and they will be healthy and thriving and easy to plant. Right now, they have great deals on spring planting essentials, up to half off on select plants. And listeners to our show get 20% off their first purchase when using the code WORLD at checkout. That's an additional 20% off better plants and better growing at fastgrowingtrees.com using the code WORLD at checkout. Fastgrowingtrees.com, code WORLD. Now is the perfect time to plant. Let's grow together. Use WORLD to save today. Offer is valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions may apply. All right, let's talk about corruption over in Europe. So last week, there was this historic election in Hungary where after 16 long years, a right-wing populist named Viktor Orban was finally ousted after losing the parliamentary elections to a party led by his former ally, Peter Magyar. It was an election that focused on anger about corruption and frankly, you know, anger at Orban's total failure to deliver for his country. Many supporters of democracy writ large are hoping that this election might provide a playbook for how to defeat other authoritarian creeps like Orban, and also that it might be a bellwether that might help us just kind of see the future and determine which direction Europe is going to go, because there's a lot of far right parties that have been doing well. So That brings us to Bulgaria, Ben. They just had an election over the weekend that seems to have some of the same dynamics at play. 4 months ago, there were these major protests against corruption and the economic state of the country, which forced the former government to resign. The Progressive Bulgaria Party, aka PB, they just won in a landslide victory on Sunday with 44.7% of the vote. The leader is Bulgaria's former president, Rumen Radev. Now, that's a, more of a ceremonial position, but he is a former fighter pilot. He commanded the Bulgarian Air Force. And, you know, he's sort of an interesting character. Like Orban, he took a bunch of pro-Russia sounding positions. He opposed Bulgarian military assistance to Ukraine. He's criticized EU sanctions. But there are questions about whether he's just sort of like posturing for the election, or whether he's really committed to these positions, or whether, you know, he's more of a pragmatist than Orban ever was. I guess we'll find out. But Radev's win was bigger than what the polling anticipated. His coalition should have a majority in parliament now. The former prime minister and the GERB party, I love the names of these parties overseas, the GERB party came in second with like 13%. The liberals got like 12% or closer to 13% too. Ben, any thoughts on sort of developments you've seen in Hungary since we last talked, and how you might interpret the elections in Bulgaria from over the weekend?
I think, first of all, in Hungary, Peter Magyar has been as aggressive as you could possibly have wanted him to be in signaling that he's going to go after Orbanism. And people may have seen these videos of him literally going on state television, which did not allow him to appear the entire campaign, and being like, my first fucking thing to do is going to be shut your ass down. You know, like, I mean, it takes some guts. It'd be yeah, like, it really, you know, going on, you know, CBS News, Barry Weiss, and being like, yeah, we're shutting you guys down.
Yeah, I'm not like a big fan of like censoring the media, but like walking into state TV and saying to your face live on air, this woman like... you're full of shit and now it's time to pay the piper. It's kind of funny.
And by the way, it's hard to overstate the extent to which Orban turned this. I mean, he literally would not allow Peter Magyar as an opponent of his to appear on, you know, so this goes beyond Fox News. Right. This was literally state media. So I think Magyar is fully justified in doing what he's doing. He signaled he's going to go after the corruption, including Orban's family members. He signaled that he would arrest Bibi Netanyahu as a war criminal if he traveled to Hungary.
Loving,
I mean, everything the guy says sounds like he's going to take a sledgehammer to Orbanism and the corruption that undergirds it. That's good. You know, the potential bad is there's a bit of a strongman persona in Magyar in doing this, and I don't know what he's going to build in its place.
Yeah, so, he was a Fidesz party member until pretty recently.
So we'll see, but so far so good. But I think what we're seeing in Bulgaria is a broader problem. There's two issues. One is just like whether the far right, are they, do they have the momentum or not? And you can find now evidence that they don't. Orban lost. Maloney's backtracking away from Trump. Or you can find, you know, looks like they're maybe getting a foothold in Bulgaria. Slovenia, which we talked about that election, where the progressive actually got the most votes, it appears that the, you know, creepy far right guy, Janša, is the one who's going to be able to form a government. And I think the problem for the EU is all Russia needs is one spoiler. I mean, and they have that in Slovakia. This guy Fico is like that too. It, you know, one country where people are probably just pissed about prices because people are pissed about prices everywhere. And so they vote out the incumbent progressive party and then the kind of pro-Russian party gets in. And then all of a sudden they're like putting sand in the gears of the EU on sanctions on Russia. It speaks that this is not sustainable. Like if all Russia has to do to like fuck up the whole EU is just find one relatively small Central or Eastern European country where there's an anti-incumbent mood and kind of surf it into having obstructionists. Now, none of these people can, it's important people know this, none of these people can take the role that Orban did. Like Orban was an absolute hub for far-right activity, for corruption. There's rumors that the Russian money was going to the Hungarians and then going to CPAC. You know, like he was bigger than just like a vote for Russia's interest in the EU. But I do think that this speaks to a problem where the EU has to get away from like unanimity of decision making, because they're always going to have some pain in the ass leader in some country.
Definitely. You know. Definitely. But yeah, I agree with you. It does look like a bit of a mixed bag in those recent elections. But there's also like interesting soundings. Like Nigel Farage was asked about his relationship with Trump last week. And he said, I happen to know him, but that's by the by.
Trying to walk this is a guy that basically lived in the lobby of that Trump hotel.
I was just kissing his ass nonstop. Lord David Frost, the former Brexit negotiator, was more critical. He said Trump was heedless of the moral element of leadership and undeserving of support. He said a moral line has to be drawn somewhere. And this week, Trump went beyond it. That was in an op-ed. In Germany, we've talked about the AfD party, the neo-Nazi party. They're distancing themselves themselves from Trump, especially the Iran war. And then Marine Le Pen, who's like a longtime ally and supporter of Trump, told the French media that Trump's moves in Iran were erratic and the consequences would be, quote, catastrophic. So again, like, it's just this weird place where the far right is willing to be critical of Trump on Iran in ways that inexplicably Keir Starmer, the Labour prime minister in the UK with a 50-point underwater approval rating, will not, even though every time he does, it seems to benefit him politically. I can't make sense of it.
It tells you, and we said this last week, but that Trump is the best thing going for anti-far-right politics because he's such an albatross on these people that they're running away from him. But to your Keir Starmer point, if the fucking AFD can figure out that one way to boost your numbers is to stand up to Trump, it's pretty extraordinary that Keir Starmer can't seem to draw the same lesson.
Yeah, like, look, I guess in fairness, it's easier to be in opposition. And when you actually have like government to government relations and you're managing this special relationship, like, sure, there's some way Trump could punish you. I just think,
Georgia Maloney,
political malpractice. I think I'm trying to be charitable. Yeah. I don't believe what I'm saying.
Yeah.
No, Tell the fucking king not to go on the trip. That would send a message.
Yeah, Georgia Maloney had no problem saying to Trump, yeah, like, why is King Charles like, you know, don't come here. You know, like, you're pissed about this war. I mean, Britain gets a significant amount of its energy from Qatar that's now offline. Like, that's going to screw over a bunch of people. Like, I just, there's no, what are you getting? I mean, actually, let's just look at it from the other standpoint. Like, what is Keir Starmer getting from being kind of
getting called
scared
not
of his
Winston
shadow.
Churchill?
Yeah, getting called
Neville Chamberlain on the reg.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's going great. Yeah, Trump's going to take the king to like a monster truck rally or something.
Oh, my God.
I wonder if he'll go to the Ultimate Fighting event. That'll be fun.
Maybe he can be a part of Joe Rogan's like pilot psychedelic program.
Take a little Ibogaine.
Yeah, take a little psilocybin MDMA journey.
That sounds like more fun. The Ibogaine shit.
No, I think let's. I'll be in the other clinical trials. I'll be in the MDMA one.
I will take you and I can take King Charles. Is Camilla gonna come?
I'm sure she's gonna come.
We'll take them to the Sphere.
Yeah.
We'll see if like Dead & Co will kind of run it back.
Just run it back.
Have a good ass time.
Yeah.
Okay. We solved that one. So let's find two more things. So we're going to talk about the latest from Cuba. The New York Times and Axios reported that a senior delegation from the U.S. had visited Cuba for negotiations. It's like the highest level talks since the Obama administration. Those talks were reportedly about like economic reforms, getting them to a market-based economy, releasing some political prisoners, not regime change. The talks have been primarily with President Raul Castro's family, not with the president of Cuba. Castro is 94 years old. So again, he's going to regime change himself pretty soon, but his kids are included, including his grandkids. His son, Alejandro Castro Espin, who is known as the one-eyed man because of an eye injury from when he was in Angola. Ben, I know you know this guy. He's been part of them. Then there's Raul Rodriguez Castro, who is supposedly Raul's favorite grandson. He was like his bodyguard, his body guy. He's like the keeper of Castro's phone and controls like messages that come to and from him. He's also known as the crab because he was born with a sixth finger on one hand. These guys have awesome nicknames. Imagine if like the Obama kids were known as like the crab and like the one-eyed man.
I'm not kidding, over 1,000 hours with Alejandro Castro because we'd have these marathon multi-day negotiating sessions, or at least hundreds of hours, several. I'll say he lost an eye in Angola. You kind of notice it. I mean, there's something in there, you know, but there's a fundamental unseriousness to how they, you know, I never was like, I'm off to meet the one-eyed man. You know what I mean? Like, these people seem like they're fucking kids in a movie. It's like, it's the same way that Cash Patel likes to, you know, work out at Quantico. Like, mm-hmm. There's a fantasy camp element to them giving these nicknames of the crab and the one-eyed man. That's the first point.
The crab is not a nickname that I would want.
No. Or the one-eyed man, for that matter.
No. The crab's got an insinuation. What are these talks? What is happening? What's happening here?
So I think what's happening is...
Do you think that Iran is making them pump the brakes on this shit, as I guess by threshold question? Because, they know it's not going well. No one has any bandwidth to do another regime change, at least not militarily. So, like, what is the path? How do you slow the roll?
I assume that what they want is... So what's interesting is they clearly think Venezuela was a huge success. Trump talks about it a lot. And look, the problem for Trump is, sure, he got Maduro. Delcy Rodriguez is in there. She's cracking down on all her opponents.
Yeah, purging all the Maduro loyalists.
Including Maduro people. But she's still a socialist, strong woman. And I guess we get some oil occasionally from them or something. But here's the problem. Like, most Americans just don't give a shit. Like, no Americans like, you know what? My life is demonstrably better because we deposed Maduro.
Right. So, a few people in Miami.
So then I think they look at Cuba and they're like, well, we could do that, right? Like, we could, get rid of the leader and... But here's the problem. Like, they don't have oil in Cuba, And so I imagine the potential deal could be... I'm sure the Cubans would be willing to open up their economy. They were before with us. And what Cuba has is real estate, right? So they have beachfront property, quite literally, like the whole north coast of Cuba facing Florida, beautiful beaches or beautiful keys. And you could say in a very corrupt way, hey, the Miami Cubans can come in here and own this land and develop hotels on it. Maybe the Trump, throw in a Trump Tower or two and a golf course. And maybe Miguel Diaz-Canal, the president of Cuba, he goes. He's the Maduro in this scenario. And they try to find some Delcy Rodriguez-type person that Raul Castro is okay kind of taking the place. The problem with this is, first of all, Diaz-Canal doesn't run Cuba. I mean, that's evident by the fact that they're...
Not even talking to him.
He's not even in the way that Maduro ran Venezuela. Like, he was never... Raul's been the kind of, emeritus leader of the country. The military's got a deep interest in the economy because it's a sanctions economy and they control a lot of stuff. And Diaz-Canal is kind of an apparatchik who's kind of the front man. So I think that the Eli Lakes of the Cuban hardliners know that just getting Diaz-Canal out doesn't change that regime at all. Like, it just means a musical chairs in the president's seat. For what, a real estate deal? And it's kind of like, why did we go through all this?
To what end?
We did a fuel blockade. We killed Cubans, literally, because there were power shortages at hospitals. Like, we've killed Cubans with our sanctions in the recent months so that, like, some Miami Cubans tight with Marco Rubio can, like, invest in real estate. Because I don't know what else Cuba can concede, If they're not becoming a multi-party democracy tomorrow, which they're not going to regime change themselves— there's not much for them to concede. They can release political prisoners and, again, like, give property to Americans. But, like, I just, what is this all about?
I don't know.
And how does it help Americans?
And once again, like, it seems like through these talks, the administration is further empowering the next generation of Castros.
Yeah, the crab.
Just empowering, six-finger guy and the one-eyed guy and rinse, repeat. I don't know, man. I guess hurry up and wait and we'll keep watching. Final story, Ben. So longtime listeners of the show know that we have issues with some of the people in the administration, but that we're huge fans of FBI Director Kash Patel.
Yeah.
He is eminently qualified for the job.
Very competent.
He's a great leader. He's an expert in all facets of law enforcement. And so it was shocking to me personally to learn via a recent report in The Atlantic magazine that Kash is not nearly as popular within the FBI itself as he is with us on this show. So according to this report, Kash Patel, the FBI director, he's routinely drunk on the job. And by the way, this is a 24/7 job. The piece says that on multiple occasions, his security detail had trouble waking Kash up because he was so shit-faced. And in one instance, they had to make a request for equipment used by SWAT teams to break down doors. So that is drunk. I don't know that I've been that drunk in a long time.
I guess he didn't have, what's that product you guys?
Z-Biotics.
Yeah, he just didn't have the Z-Biotics.
Yeah, it's like the 400 Z-Biotics next time.
You could help him out. We could ship him some Z-Biotics.
I'm happy to help him out because, again, I'm a big fan. The Atlantic piece reported that meetings with FBI staff have to be scheduled around his hangovers and that he is, quote, erratic, suspicious of others, and prone to jumping to conclusions before he has necessary evidence. Seems like bad tendencies for the FBI director. He's also incredibly paranoid about getting fired to the point where he flipped out about some random IT issue and thought it meant that the White House had locked him out of his accounts. now, this paranoia might be justified. The article says that senior White House officials have had conversations about who might replace Kash. We also saw Minecraft head Dan Bongino leave his job as deputy to go be a podcaster again. So, Ben, I mean, this is not the first report that outlines all the ways that Kash Patel is kind of a joke and treats the job like it's fantasy camp. There was his request to go jet skiing at a conference of our closest intelligence sharing allies, the Five Eyes. We know that Cash uses the FBI's private jet to fly to Italy for the Olympics, to fly to Pennsylvania to watch his girlfriend sing at some low rent wrestling contest, to fly to a place called the Boondoggle Ranch.
I love that you always include that one.
I love the Boondoggle Ranch. Can we go? Think we could expense
that? I'd like to
go
to the Boondoggle Ranch.
If I can get us a ticket, will you go with
me? It sounds like the kind of place where that guy shot Dick Cheney in the, or Dick Cheney shot that guy in the face.
Yeah. You know, like, and if you and I go, that'll be us. But like, this is the first time I've seen the argument that the people in the FBI think Cash Patel is a threat to national security because of his mismanagement of the role. Now, the counter argument you hear is like, look, every minute Cash Patel is designing his like FBI Punisher logo challenge coin is a minute he's not like fucking up ongoing FBI operations. I'm not sure I buy that. I see a pretty big opportunity cost here. But what did you make of this this article?
Oh, God. I have some thoughts, man. So first of all, I love that he's suing The Atlantic for $250
million.
When Lorian Jobs owns The Atlantic, so I think she can cover the legal fees.
Yeah, just dig it in the couch for that.
Also, what's interesting about this is that we saw the guy like shotgun a fucking beer at the Olympics with the hockey team, and he looked like Will Ferrell in Old School. Like, remember when Will Ferrell shotguns first beer, and he's like, oh, yeah. Like, that's exactly how Cash is acting. Yeah, it's just like it was activating all the like
Frank alcohol. The Tank.
Yeah. And so it is completely believable that this guy, I mean, we know he was at like Rouse. Remember the, I think maybe when Charlie Kirk got killed or something, he was at like, you know.
Tweeting out wrong information.
Yeah.
He's always in Las Vegas. It's something called the Poodle Club.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you don't
I
go there to drink seltzer.
No,
you know, he's not the kind of guy who orders a club soda on the plane. He's the
line.
Kind of guy who's getting the two, you know, bottles of
two
wine. Trials. You know, so it's eminently believable that he's a drunk. And to be serious about it, like you remember, Tommy, like when shit happens, like the FBI director, I remember the Boston Marathon bombing? Like
I just left, but yes.
Okay, so you just left. So Bob Mueller was, I mean, rest in peace, was in the fucking Situation Room for like hours, you know, and he's briefing Obama and he's on the phone with agents in Boston and he's managing up and down and around and he's briefing Congress. Like shit happened on the regular where,
and there was stuff like that we never learned about, like ongoing investigations that were so sensitive that like the White House people were never briefed that they're managing. Yeah, like that is a 24/7 job, literally.
You will get woken up in the middle of the night and asked a question like, who do we have to notify about this, or can you call your counterpart in this other country because there's a terrorist plot and we need someone at the FBI director level to call the head of MI5 or something. Like, shit like this happened all the time. So if he can't function on the job because he's hammered for hours at a time, like, that's dangerous. I'd also say, like, what is Cash Patel even doing in this job? Because, like, what is his vision of the FBI? Because all that seems to get him geeked is to have, like, ultimate fighting people come and train agents or to change the logo. Like, he has no vision of, like, how to reform the Bureau. Like, I mean, he's so incompetent and people are so innocent that he's not even persecuting Trump's opponents because he's too incompetent to do that. I mean, and then the last thing is, I read the piece and it kind of explains to me, Tommy, I don't know, remember when he was, like, posting, like, through the Charlie Kirk investigation, like, we got the guy, he's in custody. Like, it felt like drunk tweeting.
Totally.
You know?
It was.
We've all been
too.
There.
Absolutely
but
been
when
there.
I've done it, it's usually been, like, I'm at the end of a dinner that's not that interesting, so I start looking at my phone. I've had a few, and I'm like, I'm going to tweet about this.
No,
I'm not the FBI director.
No, usually for me, I'm walking back to the main stage at Coachella, the Molly's wearing off, and I just want to weigh in on the Hungarian election. You know?
Yeah, you've run out of things to talk to Katy Perry about,
you're
just going to weigh in on the Hungarian. Katy doesn't want to hear your takes on the Hungarian election, so you're going to share it with your
millions
of followers.
The honeymoon phase is over. Yeah. All she wants to talk about is Bieber. All I want to talk about is Orban. It's just like, I got to tweet it out.
Yeah.
One organization that seems to have kind of grasped who Cash is whoever made this Lego movie about him. I don't even know if it's the Iranians anymore. They're all getting credited.
It's
entirely a meme, but whoever made this one had a good ass time with it. Let's watch.
Crazy eyes, let's go. Cash Patel, crazy eyes, Epstein files, cover up lies, Trump name redacted, Congress stonewalled, swore you drop them, but you crawled. Charlie Kirk shot, wrong guy in cuffs, we got him. Total bust. Olympics hockey locker room champ. FBI jet to Milan. You absolute tramp. My side honeypot.
my fire. Meltdowns, what a leak out. Purging the pros, installing the bros. The whole bureau's burning. We didn't start the fire. It was always burning. Since the world's been turning. We didn't start the fire. No, we didn't start the fire, but Cash, you're the one who's torching the whole damn thing.
Maybe AI is good.
It is. I mean, we found a good use for it.
Yeah.
I mean, the amazing thing about that is that there's every single narrative about Cash, because we've been covering them all on this podcast, is somehow in like a 1 minute video.
Yeah, how did they do it?
From, I mean, he does have crazy eyes. Him yeah. getting hammered at the Olympics.
The Flavor and Podcast guys call him Cockeyed Cash.
Yeah, him posting the wrong guy was caught and Charlie Kirk. Like everything that this guy's done, like they can just grab that and within like an hour, like churn out like this AI video that's honestly like pretty interesting to watch. Now, they always have the Israel control thing.
They always have that.
So they always have, you know, Alexis Wilkins, Mossad, the girlfriend, his Mossad honeypot. But yeah, man, it couldn't happen to a better guy than Cash, I have to say.
I wonder if there'll be a Kalshi market on how long it takes her to dump him after he's fired. I guess we'll find out.
You know, if he can't have a SWAT team guard her. Actually, notes on the IRGC Lego video.
Work that in there.
They left that out, that there's a SWAT team that basically provides security for his girlfriend. Come on, guys. Do better.
Do better,
yeah.
IRGC.
Yeah.
Whoever made this. Wow. Good stuff. Anyway, hopefully Trump fires Cash Patel.
Yeah.
He's on a firing spree lately. It's just self-evident that this guy is not qualified.
Maybe the point is it just... things just haven't been the same since Bongino left.
Yeah.
He's holding the whole place
together.
Bongino
was holding the place
together. He's holding it all up in his shoulders.
With his gigantic
Minecraft
square
head.
Minecraft head. Okay, that's it for the news portion of the show. But please stick around for my conversation with Nick Enrich. We talk about his book, Into the Wood Chipper. It's a whistleblower's account of what it was like when USAID got doged by Elon Musk, his idiot friends, and presumably, reportedly, allegedly, a whole bunch of ketamine. So stick around for that.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. When it comes to sending money abroad, many providers claim to offer free fees and competitive rates. But don't be fooled. This can be code for inflated exchange rates. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive money in over 40 currencies without ever having to worry about hidden fees. Sending pounds across the pond, most transfers arrive in 20 seconds or less. Spending reals in Rio, the Wise travel card gives you the mid-market rate on every purchase, no costly markups on your bill. Getting paid in dollars for your side gig, avoid hidden fees, and get the real exchange rate every time. With 24/7 access to live support, your international transactions with Wise are quick, transparent, and safe. Plus, Wise runs over 7 million daily checks to catch and prevent fraud. 15 million people trust Wise to manage their money internationally. Be smart. Get Wise. I got to tell you, my co-host on the show, Ben Rhodes, was telling me, he's like, no, the best way to spend money abroad is just pallets of cash. Just slip it on a C-17 and you're good. And I was like, Ben,
if that's not for you.
No. Wise is so much easier than shipping giant pallets of cash abroad.
This is true.
You can use it. You always get the best exchange rate. You can use it to buy stuff. It like could not be easier. If you're going to multiple countries, try Wise.
Especially when the dollar is going to be worthless pretty soon.
Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. My guest today is the former Bureau of Global Health's Director of Policy Programs and Planning for USAID. His new book is Into the Wood Chipper, a whistleblower's account of how the Trump administration shredded USAID. It's a very evocative title, and I assume one where you needed much less ketamine to come up with it than Elon did for his famous tweet. Nick Enrich, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Great to meet you. So let's start by just, you know, kind of talking about a bit about your time and work you did at USAID pre-Elon. You were there for over 12 years across four administrations. What did you focus on and what was your proudest accomplishment?
Yeah, so I was, as you said, the Director of Policy Programs and Planning for the Global Health Bureau, which was essentially the CFO, COO position of that bureau. My job was to make sure that we had the resources we needed for global health and that we were using them as efficiently as possible to achieve our health goals. And, you know, my job was to come up with ways to make things better. And I think that's where I was the most proud. One of the last things, sadly, that I did in the last administration was come up with a new global health policy for the agency. We had actually never had one before for our whole global health sector. And we thought that this would be a great way to get a little bit more efficient in the way that we would administer our programs. I also had a list. When I heard DOGE was coming in, I had a list of things that I wanted to do to improve the agency that I thought would be the kinds of things that DOGE would be excited to hear about. Obviously, quite naively, because I never actually got a chance to share any of those ideas.
So like far from battling these guys, you were like, oh, I got some ways to make this place more efficient. Here's my literal list of things we could do to, you know, make money go further.
Yeah, they were called the Department of Government Efficiency. Right. And, you know, in the abstract, it sounded like a good idea. But the reality was it was no such thing.
Yeah. So let's talk about that reality. So by now, I imagine everyone listening knows how this story unfortunately ends. It's Elon Musk and a bunch of like young, arrogant kids from the tech world just rampaging through USAID and destroying it. That decision alone is estimated to have already led to 750,000 deaths just so far. But I think listeners might not fully grasp just how careless and ignorant the people in charge of this process truly were. Can you recount for listeners a story you tell in the book about what a couple of DOGE staffers said to you after most employees at the agency had been placed on administrative leave?
Sure. It wasn't until after most of the employees were placed on administrative leave or fired that I was given the opportunity to explain what we even did in global health. So I just gave a quick overview, talked about the infectious diseases that we worked to stop, our work to help save newborn babies and mothers, and a few other of the just top line highlights. And it was, I was kind of met with a stunned silence from the leadership of USAID at that point. And the chief of staff of the agency kind of like looked at me and said, wow, I had no idea you did all that. When I think of what USAID did in global health, I just assumed it was, you know, abortions.
What is your reaction in that moment? How do you even address a comment that ignorant by someone who's supposed to be the chief of staff at the agency?
It was very difficult to decide whether to laugh or cry. I knew I didn't want to argue with him because I knew that wasn't going to get me anything and get me anywhere. But it just betrayed this extraordinary level of ignorance. And to think that these were the people that had made the decision to get rid of all of our staff before they had any idea what the work was that the agency even did was shocking.
Yeah, truly shocking. So there was this moment where Elon and the boys come in to USAID. It's clear they're going to destroy some parts, but it's not clear yet if they're going to like completely upend the entire, you know, agency. I mean, ultimately they got rid of what, like 83% of all programming and folded that into the State Department. And so before USAID was fully gutted, you decided to author and then release to the media some memos about the impact to become a whistleblower. Can you tell listeners sort of what you put in those memos and how you made that decision and whether you think it made any, like, did anybody read your memos? Did anyone rethink what they were doing?
Well, so what I put in the memos, that there were three memos. The first was to describe everything we had tried to do to restart our life-saving programs, which was something that Secretary of State Rubio had promised was going to happen as they tore down USAID. But yet they didn't let us restart any of our programs. And in fact, they stopped us at every possible turn. So that was the first memo. The second was about how they decimated our staff and really just traumatized the workforce for the about 6-week period in which I was responsible for global health. And then the third memo documented what the impacts were going to be of the cuts to USAID, including potentially up to 2.6 million lives lost per year and tens of millions of mothers not being able to receive emergency life-saving care and numerous other issues. Did it make a difference? Well, USAID was still destroyed. Some of the contracts that had been terminated that were necessary to do our most life-saving projects were actually restored in the few days after my memos were released. But that was about it. I had kind of hoped that this would light a fire under Congress or others to be able to shed some light on exactly what was happening there. But unfortunately, the end of the story is not a happy one.
Yeah. Marco Rubio is a real villain in my view, because, you know, he was once a huge supporter of USAID and its work. In fact, I've heard you say in other interviews that people at the agency were a little bit relieved when he was named Secretary of State, because his record suggested that he understood USAID, he understood the value, and that he might support it or protect it. Why do you think he completely turtled on this and reversed himself? And like, what's your take on Rubio now?
Yeah, I mean, he certainly did not live up to the estimation that I and other staff at USAID had thought we were going to get, which was a longtime staunch supporter of foreign aid and development. Instead, we got lies. We got Rubio saying that no one has died as a result of the cuts to USAID, which was just blatantly not true. And he went further and blamed the USAID career officials for being insubordinate, for not restarting programs that his own team was preventing us from doing. And look, maybe he got lost somewhere in the connection between the waiver that he allowed to restart life-saving programs and when that was not allowed to actually be implemented by DOGE. But this is the problem when you hollow out an agency of all of its expertise and replace it with completely incompetent and unknowledgeable and unqualified buffoons.
There was this chaotic period, right, where like Trump takes over, Elon comes in, DOGE goes to USAID first. There's like a freeze on programming. Then they say, oh, life-saving stuff will continue. Then it's clear that that's not happening. Like, now that you have some time and space from that period of time, was the chaos lying? Was it people not really knowing like what the left hand was doing to the right? Or like what was happening there? Like, what was all the competing statements and the confusion and the kind of bullshit that was coming out of the Trump administration's leadership in that period?
Yeah, I mean, certainly there were lies and there was cruelty to an unbelievable degree. But I think the thing that people maybe underestimate the most, and maybe what has the most the most relevance for other agencies, perhaps, is the level of sheer incompetence that we saw. These were people who were not just unknowledgeable of global health or international development. They had really no idea how government even works. And frankly, they were really terrible managers of people and projects. So, you know, they had been tasked with an unreasonable assignment to dismantle, an agency that delivered foreign aid over six decades. And you can imagine things are going to go wrong with a project like that. And when they inevitably did, the people who were in charge just had no idea how to fix those problems and ended up just making things worse. It was a lot of like table smacking and yelling at each other and not understanding what was happening because they had already gotten rid of most of the experts that would have been able to help them do it.
That's a great way to run a railroad there. Get rid of all the people who understand the building and then try to dismantle it. If you had like 2 minutes in an elevator with Elon Musk and that period to explain to him what he did and the impact it had on the world, what would you tell him?
You know, somebody said that the image of the world's richest man killing the world's poorest children is not a pretty one. And I would love to convey that because I do feel like the destruction of USAID had nothing to do with improving efficiency or fighting waste or realigning foreign aid with some, you know, the new president's priorities. This was the just destruction of an agency for the sole purpose of satisfying the ego of a billionaire. And it's something that I'm still quite angry about, as you can probably tell.
Yeah, I can only imagine. I mean, I'm sure like waking up every day to read these insane tweets from this like ketamine addled monster who seemed to just take glee in harming the agency, upsetting employees, being an asshole, but it just must have been horrifying.
Yeah, I mean, there was a day where I think he tweeted over 40 times between like 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning about USAID. And this was on a Sunday night. And on that Monday morning, there were some of my colleagues were asking me, is it safe for us to come in the building? I mean, he's calling us criminals. He's calling us a ball of worms. He's calling us evil. I didn't really know what to tell them. The good bureaucrat I was, I said, well, we haven't gotten guidance to not come into the office, so we should still come. These were kind of my normal tendencies that I had to fight against, and what took me so long to decide that there was no way that I was actually fulfilling my oath as a civil servant to be doing what I was being told to do. And that's why I eventually felt like I needed to stand up and say something.
Yeah, I mean, it is hard to remember back to those days where he's essentially accusing USAID of being like a criminal organization and evil. And I mean, just the vindictive nature of the attacks was you know, shocking and baseless. So let's just look forward a little bit. A lot of voters genuinely don't want to spend U.S. taxpayer dollars overseas, whether it's on a war or development. They think it's a waste. You've probably heard all the kind of isolationist, nationalist arguments against foreign aid or foreign spending that can frankly be really convincing. But I do think some of those people could be persuaded by national security arguments in favor of foreign aid. So in your opinion, what are some ways that destroying U.S. aid is hurting our national security now and making Americans less safe?
Yeah, I mean, there's several ways. The first is specific to infectious diseases. And that's the one that keeps me up at night, because I think the shortest term threat is from a new disease or an existing disease that we're no longer able to detect coming to our borders, because we are currently flying blind when it comes to an early warning system that we had previously set up within USAID to help countries detect and treat and respond to outbreaks before there was any chance of them spreading. And now those systems have been ripped up and we have no idea. We're basically conducting biosafety and biosecurity policy by crossing our fingers and hoping. So that's the thing that scares me most. And what we saw when we would issue these warnings to the Doge team and the political appointees as they were tearing it down was just they couldn't understand. So when I tried to explain, for example, that when they froze aid, they froze clinical trials testing new drugs for drug-resistant tuberculosis, that these were our antibiotics of last resort. And when we interrupt treatment of those, it allows for the potential development of new strains of an airborne infectious disease that we no longer have any antibiotics to treat. And when I would say that, I told that to the leadership at USAID, and they told me, they asked me if I could make Barney style slides to explain them in a way that non-health experts could understand.
Barney style?
Barney, like the dinosaur, the children's dinosaur.
That's who are those for? For Trump?
I guess I don't know who they were for. I mean, it certainly was for nobody that was going to be making rational decisions about national security.
Yeah, that's unnerving. I'm trying to imagine what a Barney style briefing about drug resistant tuberculosis looks like. I don't want to watch that show. I can tell you that much. Not with my kids. But okay, continue. That's horrifying. That's an awful image.
Yeah. So that's sort of the most immediate threat that keeps me up all night. The longer term, you know, USAID was the embodiment of American generosity. And I think it was preserving partnerships in ways that are done so much more efficiently and effectively than you'll ever see from what can be run out of the State Department or the Department of Defense when we try to lead by coercion and the use of force. I mean, I think it was General Mattis under the last Trump administration said that if you cut foreign aid, you're going to need to buy me more bullets. And I think that's really true. President Obama said that for many people around the world, USAID is the US. And I think that's right, too, because a lot of people, the only engagement that they ever had with the US was through the generous support that we offered them under the banner of From the American People. And I'm afraid of what's going to happen in the world where that no longer exists and they don't have that image of the United States.
Well, no, luckily everything else is going really great. And we have kicked off this catastrophic regime change war in Iran. We have the president tweeting, you know, praise Allah on Easter and insulting all Muslims and all Christians at the same time. So I don't really know what could go wrong there. Okay. So again, looking forward, you couldn't put USAID back as it was if you wanted to, right? Because all the infrastructure and partnerships and expertise, it's gone. And there's just no way of kind of like fixing that. But the next Democrat who wins the presidency is going to want, I imagine, some sort of reformed, updated version of USAID. Do you have a sense of kind of a back of an envelope kind of sketch of what that might look like? Or also, is there anyone, like a group of experts out there somewhere kind of trying to rethink USAID for that next iteration that hopefully we could, you know, get through Congress or get done and get back running?
Yeah, I mean, I actually maybe am more optimistic than you. I believe that USAID could be rebuilt and not that difficult. in not that difficult of a way. And frankly, I think it should. Like, again, let's not think that it was torn down because that was a good idea or that it wasn't working or anything like that. The reality was, as I mentioned, it was torn down by people who had no idea what it actually did. The counter argument is to keep it where it's now being tried to fold into the State Department. And I think that's a problem for several reasons. First, I think it ends up having, for the same reason that we wouldn't just suggest combining the State Department and the Department of Defense, which are two separate pillars of foreign policy, so too is development, which is a third critical policy, a pillar of foreign policy. And we're already seeing with them trying to run foreign aid out of the State Department is major problems because of that tangle as they try to kind of shoehorn it into their transactional diplomacy where they exchange the idea of HIV treatment for millions of people in exchange for access to critical minerals, for example, which is just, it really kind of defeats the purpose of everything that we've learned about how development policy works and builds partnerships over years. So that's one piece. The second is, as I mentioned earlier, having an independent agency that is the face overseas of American generosity is symbolically important. And that flag and that logo of the handshake and the for the American people, I think, is important for projecting American goodwill and generosity overseas. And I think that on its own has value. Personally, I find that folks who say, well, you know, it's over, USAID is done and nothing's coming back, it's kind of like a lack of boldness and a lack of creativity that sort of allowed USAID to collapse in the first place. And so I'm hoping that the next administration, even the next Congress, is looking forward to boldly taking on the rebuilding of USAID. And I think it's something that is not a hard lift. I think it's very popular overall when people understand what it is, right? It's less than 1% of the federal budget goes to foreign aid. And with that amount, we've saved 92 million lives over the last 20 years. So I don't think it's a hard sell. I think it's just does require the political willpower to say, look, this is what we want. And there are ways to make it better. It doesn't have to be exactly the same. Like, there are some valid criticisms of USAID, and there are ways that we can use this opportunity to make it less likely to foster dependency over time, more likely to partner more closely with local organizations, have a little bit more flexibility in the earmarks that Congress has set for us so that we can address overarching problems rather than kind of stay shoehorned. There's tons of ideas that I would love to talk about for anyone who'll listen. But where I stand is we need to rebuild USAID.
All right. Well, let's hope that others in Congress share your optimism. The book is Into the Wood Chipper, A Whistleblower's Account of How the Trump Administration Shredded USAID. Nick Enrich, thanks for doing the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks again to Nick Enrich for doing the show. And I have a feeling that we're going to be talking to you before next week, guys.
Yeah.
Because yeah. Wednesday maybe is a deadline still. We don't know.
J.D. Vance, peacemaker. Yeah.
And maybe JD will go to Pakistan. That's a long flight for JD Vance.
Well, also, like, the security requirements. Like, it was dangerous for our diplomats to be in Islamabad. Like, I can't imagine what goes into, I mean, you want to talk about cost of war. Like, the cost of securing JD Vance in Islamabad has got to run into the tens and tens of millions at least.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's about it. And
by the way, I love Trump soon. Like, I salute you, Chief of General Staff of Pakistan. Like, it's so cool.
Fucking war criminal general.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Thanks for your help.
State sponsor of terror, yeah. Like, you know, LT, like, you know, Lashkar Taiba. Like, anyway.
I'm sure the Indian government loves that.
Yep.
Pod Save the World is a Crooked Media production. Our senior producer is Alona Minkowski. Our producer is Michael Goldsmith. Our associate producer is Anisha Banerjee. We get production support from Saul Rubin. Our executive producers are me, Tommy Vitor, and Ben Rhodes. The show is engineered, mixed, and edited by Jordan Cantor. Audio support by Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Thank you to our digital team, Ben Heathcote, Mia Kelman, William Jones, David Tolles, and Ryan Young. Matt DeGroat is our head of production. Adrian Hill is our senior vice president of news and politics. If you want to listen to Pod Save the World ad-free and get access to exclusive podcasts, go to crooked.com/friends to subscribe on Supercast, Substack, YouTube, or Apple Podcasts. Don't forget to follow us at Crooked Media on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter for more original content, host takeovers, and other community events. Please subscribe to Pod Save the World on YouTube for access to full episodes, bonus content, and much more. And if you're opinionated like us, leave a review. Our production staff is proudly unionized by the Writers Guild of America East.